This is Felicia Day, and you're listening to the Rule Zero Podcast.
From the Rule Zero Studios in High Bar Zoom, this is Rule Zero, the podcast for gamers to talk about gaming. All games, all gaming, all the time. Welcome to the conversation.
Welcome to Rule Zero Podcast. My name is Pete, and I've had the time of my life.
And I'm Chris, and I put baby in a corner.
You know, you're not supposed to put baby in a corner.
They tell me not to, but hey, if Chuck Norris can put baby in a corner, I can put baby
okay,
in a corner.
Okay, only Chuck Norris can, because Patrick Swayze's ghost is going to haunt you now.
Yeah, you know, I've never actually seen that movie all the way through.
Patrick Swayze's ghost?
Actually, that one I did see, but no, Dirty Dancing I've never
oh,
seen.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Well, you wouldn't because you're not a 12-year-old girl.
I saw it. You know, I saw it partway through in a hotel while I was on my way to Origins.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, you know, I know he just died, and I know I'm a heterosexual male, mm-hmm. but Patrick Swayze is a sexy, sexy man.
Oh my God, is he cute? He is just painfully cute in that movie.
But anyway, let's move on.
All right, let's.
yeah. So latest news. My gaming group rebelled.
How is that possible?
Well, you know, I was running an adventure path for two different groups. I was running the Legacy of Fire, Paizo, Pathfinder adventure path for two different groups as kind of an experiment to see how different groups would handle it.
Now,
I was getting a little burned out
right.
running it twice. So I wasn't having a lot of fun. So I kind of suggested to my Sunday group, hey, maybe we'll move on to different things. Mm-hmm. And I brought up to the Saturday group that, you know, I might be changing to a different thing there. And almost every single one of them said, can we change to a different thing?
Wow. That wasn't so much, that was a mutiny more than anything.
Yeah, and I had thought they were more into it than the original group because yep. the Saturday group has been really consistent. Everybody has been gaming together for upwards of 5 years, and we've done a couple different, you know, adventures.
Wow, upwards of 5 years. That's about how long I've been gone from Maryland.
Yeah, well, huh. That's about when it started.
I see how you are.
and so I was kind of surprised because the Sunday group has kind of rotated in and out. All of the people in my Sunday group, only one was there for the start of the campaign.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But the rest of them were kind of into the adventure path and they want to continue it. And the Saturday night group, I thought, you know, I thought the continuity of having everybody that is there, mm-hmm. there from the beginning, I thought that would be a more solid thing. But they kind of don't like being led. And there's a couple things in the adventure path where if you don't do this, you're kind of stalling.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. Yeah, we talked about that, actually. We talked about that almost a year ago, I think.
Yeah. It's been going for more than a year, maybe even up to 2 years. I'm not real sure.
Yeah. Wow.
But anyway, we're going back to my homebrew.
Nice. Wow, you're getting the band back together.
We're getting the band back together, man.
How is that possible if I can't be there to play my bard?
Different game.
Oh, damn. Okay.
Yeah, this is. You never got to. Well, you got to play in a couple sessions of this homebrew, but you were the. Visiting talent.
I was the butler.
Yeah.
Okay. I butled.
Yeah, you butled and threatened my wife's character's life.
Yes.
Which was cool.
But only because she needed it.
Yeah, that's true. So we're going back to that campaign because it was kind of put on hold because I was kind of burned out on that one.
Gotcha.
But now it's been, you know, a year and a half to 2 years and people want to go back to it.
Okay.
Only two of the players want to change characters because they weren't happy with the ones that they were playing, which is cool. I could actually tell that they weren't enjoying it.
All right. Well,
one of them had asked me to change characters shortly before we went on break. And I said, look, we're going to put this down in a couple months. Can you just, you know, get to this story point and, you know, it'll be like writing you out of the story.
Okay.
And we didn't really write him out of the story, but it was a good stopping point for his character because he achieved something that for 12 levels he had been seeking.
Oh, right. Okay.
He found his father and found out what his legacy item was supposed to be for and all that stuff.
Was this the half-orc priest?
No, the bard.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
The half-fey bard that was kind of weirdly built on a combination of 3.5 homebrew and Pathfinder rules.
Rock on.
And so, so he's going to play Dragon Disciple Barbarian Sorcerer now. And in fact, it was the half-orc priest is the other one who wants to change. So I knew that he wasn't really into playing the priest, because he wasn't really playing like a priest. He was playing like a fighter.
You know, which is funny, because when I recall some of them making their characters, and when he went to be the, what was it? He was a half-orc priest of the goddess of love, right?
It was a healing.
Right. Priest. Okay, that's right. So, I thought that was phenomenal.
I thought it was a great character idea too, concept. But he just didn't really seem interested in playing that way.
What are you going to do minus your paladin?
We'll muddle through.
Okay. What about your warlock?
I've got actually an idea of what they've been doing. Oh, okay. So when they come back from the far side of the world,
yes.
You know, they've got their story arc pretty much in the bag.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
I know one of them may be listening, and we're going to make her write up a story of what happened to their characters, and she's going to tell me how it went.
Oh, that's wonderful. I can't wait to hear that one, or read that one, as the case may be.
Yeah. Well, she's hearing it now for the first time.
Oh, all right, great. Well, I think this is the perfect venue with which to introduce these sort of things.
Yeah. All right, let's, you know, I got one news item.
You know, I got to tell you, I've just been lax on gaming. I haven't gamed anything, and I don't have anything for news.
Okay, well then let's come back and we'll talk about my one news item.
Okay, let's do that.
It is time for the news.
I have one major news item for this segment.
Lay that upon me.
Okay. You remember the Reaper Bones Kickstarter?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, that was huge. They ended up making, like, two orders of magnitude higher than they asked for.
I think it was even... I think they were asking for 30,000, and they made 3.5 million.
Wow.
So,
wow. Dag.
Well,
we are in the
not
wrong
to be swayed
line.
By, not to be swayed by mediocre results. They've gone and done it again.
Ooh, good for them.
So there's a Bones 2 Kickstarter, and this one seems kind of short. It's only a month long. It's a 25-day Kickstarter.
Really?
So by the time this show gets out, there's only going to be a few days left. Right. For the longest time, I was like, oh, I've already got so many figures. I'm not going to contribute. But you know what I just did?
You went and bought more.
Minutes ago, I just kicked in.
See how you are? You cracked me up.
Because, you know, I need another 200... you know, plastic figures.
God knows there aren't enough members of the Unpainted Army.
Yeah, I've already got a box full of figures. And, like, I have so... the only thing... I'm not a huge, great figure painter.
Right.
I'm a better figure painter than I am a figure skater.
I can see that.
But that's really as far as I'd go.
Fair enough.
And I've already got more than I'm ever going to get to. But you know what? That's a good deal.
Yeah. No, plus, you know, all those Unpainted Figs legacy right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so in a 25-day Kickstarter, their goal was 30,000. I think they made it in minutes. I think
sure.
It was under an hour.
Oh, my God. That,
as right now, as of 7 days to go, they're hovering just under the 2 million mark. I know that's going to
be... They must feel like One Direction at this point in time.
Oh, my God.
You know, just selling out tickets like crazy.
Yeah. And it's like the Jonas Brothers of miniatures.
Exactly.
So really that was the only news item I had. I mean, the deal looks good. There's a lot of figures. There's a couple that I'm pretty sure are repeats.
Yes.
I could be wrong, but I'm reasonably certain I've seen some of these before.
So was there a big teaser for you to contribute? Especially, I remember at certain levels, like you got the succubus at one level and.
Yeah, well, it's, at the $100 level in the last time they called it the vampire level. Now they're calling it the core set level.
There you go.
So your $100 pledge receives all of these figures that they promised from the core set and all of the stretch goals that they're throwing into the core set donation level.
Wow.
And I'm right now, it looks like I'm looking at, you know, maybe 100 figures, maybe more.
Jesus, sweet mother of God, man.
For $100.
And you know what you should do is you should have a figure painting party.
That's not a bad idea,
yeah, you should.
Actually.
I think that'd be an excellent thing.
One thing they're doing with the backing levels right now mm-hmm. is they're selling not only the $100, you know, pledge level, but they're also selling you the shipping wave. So,
oh,
like,
okay.
If you were early in on this Kickstarter and you contributed and bought at the $100 level, you could contribute for wave one shipping.
Oh, wow.
And I actually got in, there was like one slot left in the wave two shipping. I'm going to guess somebody canceled their decision.
Right.
And that opened up. But I saw it this afternoon. I'm like, wave two, one left. I'm like, dibs.
No doubt. No wonder you jumped on it.
Yeah. So, I mean, wave three, wave four look like they're sold out now. Yeah, wave four is sold out. There's a few left on wave five. So, I mean, they're not only selling, or they're not only letting you pledge at the level, they're letting you pledge your shipping wave.
Nice. Wow.
So you're not actually saving any money if you choose wave seven. You're just saying, I don't really care when I get these.
Right, exactly. Whereas it took a while for you to get your originals, as I recall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's my only news item. It looks good. Check it out if you get time.
Please do.
Hopefully you'll get in on this before they're gone if you want to.
Here, here.
And if you missed it the first time, there it is again.
And I promise to have a news item for next time.
I will hold you to that.
I'm sure you will.
Okay.
Okay. And so who do we have coming up?
We have Tracy Barnett coming up.
Woo-hoo!
And it's a great interview. And let's look into the future and say, okay, we did this interview a couple nights ago. And it was a really great interview, and you guys are going to love it.
Really. That's true.
This is The Heart of the Matter.
Welcome back to The Heart of the Matter. This episode, we have an interview with Tracy Barnett. Say hi, Tracy.
Hi.
Tracy has a number of game writing credits to his name.
Yeah, would you like me to go through the list?
Please.
That would actually be a great start.
Okay, excellent.
So tell the listeners who you are.
So I am Tracy Barnett. I am the owner, operator, head bottle washer for Sand and Steam Productions, the company that I founded a couple years ago. I have two games that I published myself, School Days, which won a Judge's Spotlight Any.
We mentioned that in our last episode. Congratulations on that.
Thank you
very much. Congratulations.
And my second game is One Shot, which, due to the time, didn't get submitted for any awards, but that's cool because I still like it. I've got a couple of freelancing things that are floating out there, although I'm not sure that, I think one of them has been published. It's an Amaranthine that Machine Age Productions did. And I have successfully kickstarted my first novel. I'm
Fantastic.
Working on writing that right now. It's called Iron Edda Sveed's Daughter. And I'm preparing for what is probably the biggest project I've done to date, which is another Iron Edda property, but it's the role-playing side of things. So it's a Fate
nice.
Game called War of Metal and Bone.
And you said it's based on Fate?
Yes, the original one will be. One of the freelance things that I mentioned was for also Machine Age Productions, Apotheosis Drive X Kickstarter. They were looking for pitches for alternate settings, and I pitched the idea of Norse myth and dwarven mechs rising up to fight the humans, and the humans bonding their spirits to the bones of dead giants to fight back, called Bones of the Earth. And because it's Creative Commons licensed and David and Philomena are awesome, that setting, the thing that I wrote for Apotheosis Drive X, is actually the basis of my Iron Edda stuff that I'm doing now. So the novel is set in that same world, and the Kickstarter is taking what I did for the coming Kickstarter, for War of Metal and Bone, is taking what I did in Bones of the Earth and expanding it out to a full fleshed out setting.
Gotcha. Nice.
Thanks.
Very nice. Usually what we do when we have guests on the show is we ask them about their gaming chops.
Define chops for me.
Well, what's your background in gaming? What got you started? How long have you been doing it? How many different games have you played other than the ones you've created?
I have been gaming actively for probably about a decade now.
Mm-hmm.
I was introduced to RPGs when I was much younger. It's actually a story that's pretty common. You know, I had a cousin who owned the Red Box, and I saw them, you know, a couple times a year, and I thought dragons were awesome. And so I owned the Red Box and the Blue Box, but never actually really played a session until D&D 3rd Edition came out.
All right.
And played in a couple of long-term campaigns with the same group of friends. And then it was at Origins in 2009, which was my first Origins, that I first played stuff that was not Dungeons and Dragons or D20 based.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember
what been my first one too?
Pardon?
Do you remember what you played? Oh, that was your first Origins, but I was wondering if Tracy remembered what he played.
I played a lot of stuff in the Cthulhu Mythos. That was the year Cthulhu Tech came out. I remember playing that. I played All Flesh Must Be Eaten. It was a sci-fi movie mashup. I actually got to play Riddick on a zombie planet, which was pretty freaking awesome, actually.
Fun.
I played Delta Green and Cthulhu
Green.
In BRP.
Nice.
I played Burning Wheel for the first time.
Oh, fantastic.
And
one of my personal favorites.
I spent far too much time. I actually made it to the finals of the Cheese Grinder in their one and only year at Origins.
Fun.
Yeah.
What was the Cheese Grinder?
The Cheese Grinder is something that I guess they do it at Dragon Con primarily, but basically it's a tournament. It's a round-robin tournament that takes place throughout a convention, and you either bring or grab one of their pre-generated cheesy, broken, as wild as you can make it, 11th level Pathfinder character. And play at the table for as long as your character survives.
There you go.
and like when a seat opens up, someone else sits down. And it's and they slot themselves into whatever's going on. And it's basically a series of challenge rooms. They had a bunch of different awards that they gave out for, like, you know, longest lived, quickest death, their WTF award. And I made it to the finals because of the – I won the Crispy Critter Award.
Oh, there you go.
My character died at negative 452 hit points.
Wow. Dang.
10 simultaneous bastard sword blade barriers.
Wow.
Yep.
Dang.
It's just a little spellcaster. What's the worst that could happen?
That was actually, it was a, at this point in time, it was about 3 in the morning. I was the only one at the table. So I was controlling myself and all the other NPCs. And it was a small room, and there were two like laundry chute exits off of it. And if you opened one, you saw horrible raging flames. It's like, oh, that one's not good. And if you open another one, it looks nice and clear. So I had the NPC jump down the clear one. And I heard from below, it's all clear. Come on down.
Whoops.
And I didn't think to ask if it was the NPC's voice that I heard. So it turns out that the one with the flames is the way to go.
Right.
And the other one leads to the 10 simultaneous bastard sword blade barrier traps.
Ooh, wow.
Yep.
Wow.
But anyway, yeah, that was my first Origins, and I've since played a ton of different stuff. I've discovered what a lot of people typically call story games. I love indie RPGs. Fate is one of my favorites, which is why other than the fact that that's what Bones of the Earth is based on, that's why that's the one I'm writing for the Iron Edda War of Metal and Bone Kickstarter. I'm sort of glancing at my gaming shelves, and it runs the gamut. I've got more D&D books and such, older stuff from second edition and first that I bought than anything else, but I get to use my indie stuff a lot more often.
You're preaching to the choir there, my friend.
So which is going to come first, the novel or the Fate Core game supplement or system?
They are probably going to end up getting finished right around the same time, actually. Nice. The novel, which is already, like I said, already funded, I've got the first draft of it done, and I'm in the process of doing my edits now. It's going out to beta readers at the beginning of November, and then I will edit based on their feedback during December, and then give it to my editor, who is Amanda Valentine, who is fantastic. And then we'll work with that, and the projected date to get the books printed and shipped and everything is June of 2014. The RPG Kickstarter, War of Metal and Bone, is going to start in mid-January. And because RPG products tend to be faster to produce, if only because of the lack of word count that has to be taken into consideration and the fact that I've already got the thing started, I'm also going to finish the first draft of War of Metal and Bone at the end of December,
Nice.
And that way I have something for backers to look at during that Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've got John Adamus to be my editor for that, who's done a ton of stuff for Evil Hat. And again, like I mentioned before we started recording, is an all-around fantastic editor, knows a ton of different systems, which could come in very handy for this Kickstarter.
Nice.
And so I'm hoping that I'll see at least the Fate version of War of Metal and Bone produced right around the same time frame. I don't want to shoot for to fall into the trap of trying to produce for a convention, because that can be very challenging and can put a lot of constraints on you that you don't want. Right. But I also don't see any reason why I couldn't have the novel and at least the Fate game done by Gen Con of 2014.
All right.
Okay. And how are you publishing these? How are they going to be distributed? If assuming that each individual system gets funded or gets the gets to that Kickstarter thing. I can't remember the term.
So should I give should I give people a rundown of what the stretch goals are looking like? So,
stretch goals. That's the word I'm looking for.
So everyone knows what you're talking about, because I know I've been talking about it on Twitter a lot, but that doesn't necessarily mean
true.
I mean, of course, everyone should be following me on Twitter so they can know this stuff, but still.
This goes without saying.
So how many different stretch goals do you have?
I'm going to be writing the Fate version of this game. And I've got the initial budget for that to get funded at $10,000, because that covers everything I need it to cover. Covers production, layout, art, editing, the whole nine yards. But I also want to have the option of having other systems available. So I'm hiring other people to handle the production of that stuff. So as of right now, and those stretch goals will be every $5,000, because fortunately the money works out very, very well to set them there. But as of right now, here are the systems that I have lined up, not in any particular order, to be stretch goals. Dungeon World / Apocalypse World, some brand of that. A system probably based on something someone from previous work, as of yet to be determined, by Philomena Young.
Okay.
13th Age. Say that Paul Stefko is the designer for Dungeon World, assuming it gets funded. 13th Age will be Shoshana Kesek.
Oh, nice.
Joel Sparks will be doing Savage Worlds, assuming they open the license in time. Ruth Tillman will be doing Gumshoe. Jeremy Morgan will be doing some variation on Lady Blackbird / Always Never Now.
Oh, very cool.
Which will, of course, be released for free, because that is it's Creative Commons under the same terms. So it's non-commercial. It has to be a free product. Tracy Hurley and Vivian Abraham are going to be doing Pathfinder. Rabbit Stoddard is going to be doing Warp, which is the system that underpinned Over the Edge nice. From back in the day. Mm-hmm. Cam Banks will be doing Pendragon.
Very nice.
Awesome.
Jason Pitts. I took French in high school. I try and pronounce his name properly. Will be doing a variation on his Spark RPG, which he funded not too long ago.
Cool.
Nathan Pankey will be doing an OSR AD&D second edition type riff on it.
Nice.
Will Hindmarsh will be doing a setup for his Odyssey RPG, which he's going to be doing a Kickstarter for here soon. Mark Diaz Truman will be doing a playbook, I guess you would call it, for Our Last Best Hope, his post-apocalyptic story game that has flavors of Fiasco in it. James Barlow will be doing Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition.
Ooh, very nice.
And Josh Harrison will be doing live-action roleplay rules for it.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Way to cover your bases.
Yes, I kind of wanted to hit everything that I possibly could. And in addition to the systems, I'm writing for the Fate version. It's going to focus on the country of Midgard, which is the Norse-flavored basis of this whole idea. But around Midgard are analogs to Native Americans in the Skraelings, which is what the Vikings called the natives in North America when they first saw them there. There is an analog to the Celts. There's an analog to the Roman Empire. There are elves in Midgard, and there are there's an analog to Arabia, because the Vikings went all the way down to the Muslims, the Muslim Empire at the time, which was pretty freaking awesome. And so I've got Tristan Tarwater, who's going to do the elves. I've got Jess Banks, who is going to do Legion Petrubia, which is the Roman, the Roman analog. Kate Conover is going to be doing the Isles of Mist, which is the Celtic analog. And I have Elsa Sjogrensen Henry, who is going to be doing a... I'm sort of giving her free rein on this. She's going to be doing a setting book called The Blind Guardians of Midgard, where she is going to create some new Norse-based myth around the idea of sightless warriors who can see the realms of the dead and the spirits that, that walk Midgard. And that protect... Wow. They protect Midgard from the threats of the beyond. So, gotcha. And if it, if it comes down to it, and the Skraelings and the Arabian settings get funded, I'm going to write those myself because I haven't found anyone else so far. And frankly, even at $5,000 a pop per setting book or system book, that would take this Kickstarter over $100,000. And I think I can be bothered to write those myself if that happens.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that, that would be absolutely ridiculous. I'd love for it to happen. But still, for a small one-man outfit like this to go that high, even with all the rewards that would be coming with it, that would still be, well, ridiculous is about the only word that I've got.
So these other expanded expanded world settings, these are system neutral? These are just... you know, geography and populations?
Culture, yes, the setting stuff would largely be system neutral, although I am going to encourage the writers of those to sort of adhere to what I'm laying out in the Fate version in terms of the setting. And the reason I mention that is because when I've looked at other other settings that do multiple systems, very often you just see them taking the exact same setting and reskinning it with different rules. And that works to a degree, but in like when I've read some of them, there are always sections that I'm like, well, this really doesn't work in this system because it's kind of something that hinges on it working in this other system. And the setting details just don't seem as vibrant, when ported over that way. So what I'm actually going to allow my set it or my system developers to do is to give their own takes on the setting.
Nice.
To make sure that the setting really matches the strengths of their system.
That makes sense.
The focus so the focus of gameplay in each individual system might be slightly different.
Exactly. And I think it should be. Because if you're there, there are some things where you can port it over with very little muss or fuss, right? Savage Worlds, for example, you can pin that onto just about any take of a setting, and you're going to be okay. Because Savage Worlds adapts itself very, very well. But if you look at something like Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition, you need to focus on people being heroic and very specifically play out the stories of these people who are better than everyone else around them. Fate has some of that, but not to the same degree. And if you compare both of those to something like Pendragon, I mean, for crying out loud, you've got a, there's a whole different shift there because you're talking about, I mean, Pendragon focuses on playing out the stories of the Arthurian legend. And so I'm going to be asking Cam to make up, or if he wants to, I mean, he'll have, he has much more knowledge of this than I do, but like to make up the myths of Midgard and the legends of Midgard that you get to play out. Like the story is already written. You're just, you just get to see how it actually happened with Pendragon. And that's a really, really different take than any of the other stuff. And by the same token, 13th Age and Pathfinder, though they have a lot of similarities because they're both D20, 13th Age demands icons. And things to use, you know, that relate to that. Pathfinder doesn't. Mm-hmm. And to have one where and to have that where it's not needed is just extraneous. So I really want the developers to retool the setting, aside from a few core similarities, to be something that matches their system.
Which is cool, because, you know, the other thing is that the motivation for the person to play it is how, you know, what appeals to them, what take appeals to them. And it's the same thing, like, if you grabbed a dozen people out of different places in Midgard and said, tell me about Midgard, what's Midgard like to you? You would get 12 different answers. So that makes perfect sense to have that sort of variety of system and variety of take on it.
I hope so. My other hope is that if you've got a group, say, that has two or three systems that they really dig, right? You always are rotating between Fate or Savage Worlds and, say, Gumshoe. Commercially speaking, if you buy the Fate book and the Savage Worlds book and the Gumshoe book, you're going to get fundamentally different experiences rather than just saying, oh, well, I'll buy one and then just reskin it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Try to have
that work's already been done for you, and it's going to provide a different experience for you because the setting itself has differences.
Right.
So I think that that will provide a little bit more commercial interest for a line that could be as big as 13 books if all of this gets funded. So
nice.
Are you talking paperback or hardcover?
I'm talking paperback, probably limited edition hardcovers. And the reason I can be flexible about it is because all of this is going to be done through drive-through RPGs print on demand.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
Nice.
Yeah. I had a printer that I worked with for school days in one shot that I really liked. When I got the estimated page count sort of nailed down for these books, which it's looking like they're going to be about 120 to 140 pages in 6x9 folio size, which is a fine, it's a decent size. It's not huge, but it's a decent book. The quote I got back from them was a lot higher than what I wanted. And I have, in the meantime, been transitioning both school days and one shot over to drive-through RPGs print on demand because I don't like doing fulfillment. It's kind of a pain in my neck. And the pricing was good. The ability to not have to stock anything was good. And the ability to get discounts if I order in bulk is perfect.
Nice.
Because I can build those print costs, which are fixed costs. I mean, they tell you up front exactly what the formula is to figure out how much they're going to cost. And there's no setup fees either, which is amazing.
Very nice.
Yeah, I can have all that figured out. And so say I get, I don't know what, 300 people who need the core book. I order those 300 copies direct from drive-thru, and I only have to handle shipping once. And ship out all those books, and that's it. After that, I'll print what I need for conventions. I'm relatively certain, which I need to look into this, but I'm relatively certain that I can talk to the people at drive-thru and have my stock at their booth.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
Just like Onyx Path does with all the vampire and storyteller stuff. And beyond that, I just have to direct people to drive-thru to buy the stuff. I don't have to worry about anything. I don't have to keep things in stock anywhere. It makes my life a lot easier.
Yeah, that is convenient. I heard horror stories from Jen Steen about doing Project Ninja Panda Taco.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I imagine that it was a lot more difficult for her too, because that book is outside of the normal realm of printing. It's an odd size. I'm actually looking over at my shelf, my copy of it right now. It's an odd size. It's hardback. That would be a pain in the butt. And I don't want to deal with... I'm not looking at a quantity that would require international printing and, you know, slow boat from China, literally shipping. So I don't want to mess with that. My costs are what they are, and I am not... I'm completely fine with the cost of doing business through DriveThruRPG and their print on demand service because of the convenience.
Yeah, it sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, I've got a full time job. Oh, yeah. This is not what I do for a living yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I want that to change someday, but it takes a while to get there. So yeah, I'm gonna take advantage of the of the systems that other people have in place to try and make my life easier. It's also the only reason. Similarly, a similar logic applies to how I can think I'll do all these different systems. I'm not writing them.
Oh yeah.
You know, I will give specifications to my writers and pay them to follow those.
There you go.
That's, yeah. Now, speaking of your writers, I noticed you had a lot of women named in that list of writers.
Which makes me very happy.
That's, you don't see a lot of women writers in gaming, and it's interesting that you have a lot on your list.
I feel like you see a lot more of them in the indie world, but... sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. It's something that I feel very strongly should be different about the gaming industry. The novel that I wrote, Speed's Daughter, I pitched as an inclusive Norse fantasy novel. The protagonist is a lesbian woman. I'm enlisting the help of a diverse cast of beta readers to make sure I didn't screw that up. And a similar token, it's not just in my... I don't just want my writing to be diverse. I want the people that I work with to be diverse. So, for example, for the template that anyone who pitches an adventure, because there are going to be adventures attached to these as well, anyone who does an adventure is going to write it to the specifications that Quinn Murphy, I'm pretty sure the only person of color, or just straight up the only black person I know who's a game designer. The only one at all. And now I have other people who would probably identify as people of color who are working here, but he's the only African-American man person, period, that I know that works in games.
Gotcha.
Now, that may be a sign of my limited scope of the industry, but given how hard I tried to find other people of color to work on this, I'm not sure that it is. Mm-hmm. And so I also wanted to get a very good number of women on this project. And in terms of the different systems and different settings, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, let's see, 7, 8, 9, 10 women. And we're looking at 16, I think, different standalone products. Not to mention that the person who is doing my video for the Kickstarter is a woman. My layout person, Tiara, is a woman. And I have Jess Banks doing multiple things, actually, on this project. She's going to be writing a primer on Norse myth that will go into every book.
Oh, nice. Good.
Excellent.
Well, I mean, not everyone knows Norse myth. And so... Mm-hmm. She's going to have a nice 5,000-word section that will be in every print copy or in every copy of every book, system, or setting that will talk about Norse myth, how it works, and how it's been bent or manipulated for Iron Edda.
Okay. Are you going to give Snorri Snurlson the co-writing credit?
Probably not. Frankly, just because I don't think he'll care too much. He's been dead for quite a while.
That's true. That's a good point.
Now, I'm looking at the old Kickstarter for Sveed's Daughter. Mm-hmm. Did the same person do the video for this one?
Not quite. I had the luck of having Jeremy Keller, who did the art direction for Marvel Heroic.
Oh.
I happened to meet him at a convention a few years ago. And we hit it off. He did the animation for Speed's Daughter, but the art that is in there will be done by the same person. That is Lance McCarty. I've actually already contacted Lance, and I'm working with him to get the same style of art for this video. He gave Jeremy for the Speed's Daughter Kickstarter this art in Photoshop, in the former Photoshop files, with all the layers intact. And those layers are what Jeremy animated.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
In the previous video. And so I've asked him to give more layers this time. So it can be, it can look even more animated. So for like the effect that I wanted to get was kind of like almost the reading rainbow, you know, where they animated the books.
Oh, that's actually what came to mind when I was watching it.
Same here.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that I want out of it. The video is going to be similar in terms of presentation. It's going to be short. It's going to be a minute long. There's going to be cool music, and I'll be doing a voiceover that talks about the project. But the art and the animation is going to be a little bit more animated this time, and I've asked him to put in selective highlights of color here and there as well. Okay. So you might see flashes of things as the animation progresses.
Cool.
Okay. Now also on the Speed's Daughter Kickstarter, I'm looking at the cover, which is fantastic. Is that your final cover? I mean, is that what it's going to look like?
That's the final cover for Speed's Daughter. And I am so thrilled with that cover. It's ridiculous.
It's really great.
It looks absolutely fantastic. And though Raven is the woman's name who did that. She's British. Unfortunately, I don't think she's accepting any more commissions for the rest of the calendar year, I saw her say. But that cover, art, layout, the whole nine cost 125 British pounds, so about 225 bucks.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I encourage everybody to go to Kickstarter and look for Iron Edda, Speed's Daughter. Just look for Iron Edda. You can find it that way, because nobody's going to know how to spell Speed's Daughter.
No, they're not unless, not unless you happen to be of Nordic descent and speak a Nordic-based language. You're not gonna get that. Yeah. But no,
It's too late to back the Kickstarter, but looks like something to look forward to next year, I guess.
Yeah. We're looking actually right now at about 3 months from the launch of Iron Edda: War of Metal and Bone. So yeah,
nice. Awesome. Okay, was there anything else you wanted to say about Iron Edda? Because we had a couple other questions on other topics.
Let me think if there's anything off the top of my head. I'm not sure that there is. I will say the one thing is that I am planning this Kickstarter further in advance and more thoroughly than any I have done in the past. And I'm doing, like I do all of my stuff, I'm doing it out in the open and in public. So if you want to know what goes into it, I mean, I'm being very public about where the money is going and how it's all getting put together, and I'm putting all that information up on my blog at sandandsteam.net. So if you want to know not just how it's getting set up, but my thought process behind why I'm making certain choices, you can find it all there, or find me on Twitter at the other Tracy. So,
all right.
Okay.
Yeah. On to the other questions.
Okay, so are the elves? Pete, so are the elves in your setting the Leos Alpha or the Svaltar Alpha?
They are the Alfar. They are the high elves.
So they're the Leos. They're not the Svart. They're not the dark elves.
No, correct. The dark elves in Nordic myth, it's hard to tell if the dark elves are a different kind of elf or if they mean the dwarves or what. So to give a little tiny spoiler from Speed's Daughter, the way that I'm twisting the myth is that, because in Nordic myth, you don't ever really get an origin story for the elves, light or dark. They're just sort of there.
Yep. Well, that's the way it is with the Vanir too, so. Mm-hmm.
Yep. I've got the elves, actually, the Alfar, being descended from the Jotun, the giants.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then the Dwegar, the dark elves, the dwarves, who are not like your Tolkien roly-poly dwarves, but are like the more golem-like, subterranean, creepy, we turn to stone if sunlight hits us dwarves.
Right.
They are actually high elves who descended into the ground and begin worshiping one certain trickster god.
Uh-huh.
And that's where they came from. Because, of course, this is based on Norse myth, so whose fault is it all?
Loki's.
There you go.
I've seen the flowchart.
You've seen the flowchart. Anyone who has any basic knowledge of Norse myth knows that when it all comes down to it, it's Loki's fault.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
Yes.
Okay. Indeed. Well, Pete and I were talking about School Days, and I was trying to describe it to him. And the best I could come up with, it's a combination between Fiasco, Buffy, and anime.
There are a couple different elevator pitches that I've used for it. The one that I used at this past Gen Con was it's the high school movie RPG.
There you go.
It's the game that lets you play out high school like we see it in popular media. It's not real high school. It's the high school you see on TV and in movies, because high school, actual high school, pretty much sucks, but high school movies rock.
Yeah, and they usually end with a production, musical number, so. Mm-hmm.
Which makes me happy to no end, honestly.
The other elevator pitch that I've used is I call it an NC-17 John Hughes movie.
Oh, there you go.
Awesome.
But that depends on the group.
True. Well, plus you also have shows like Twisted and Pretty Little Liars and stuff like that out there, too. So you have a whole fun little twist dynamic.
There's a wide gamut, yeah.
Yes. One of the things that I liked about when I was reading through School Days was that you make a point of it that failure is something that should be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be the case in settings like Dungeon World and Apocalypse World and things like that. Is that where you drew your inspiration, or was that something that came to you separately during a different storytelling type game, or where did that come from?
Well, it's something, I mean, School Days, I'm pretty sure Apocalypse World was out before School Days was, but I know that I hadn't read it.
Okay.
I do know that I had played some story games, and as has been said, Fiasco was a big influence for how I, at least how I run School Days, if not in the writing of it as well.
Okay.
And some of the best parts of stories are when things don't go the way you expect them to.
Right.
I can tell you that, to be perfectly blunt, when I was designing it, I really just put that in there because I didn't want people to be like, "Oh well, I failed. I can't do it," because that just sucks. I mean,
no, it does.
Yeah, it's just no fun. It's mm-hmm. much more fun to look at failure not as a dead end, but just as a turn for the story.
And it is really grist for the mill, I mean, yeah. When it comes down to it. Because one of the challenges that Tris and I have discussed prior, you know, just from the craft point of view, is that you really, you know, coming up with a good villain, coming up with a good twist should something fail, you know. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. You trying not to be hindered by the rules too much by being able to take this in a different direction, maybe. You know, it's what keeps it alive and keeps it vital.
Yeah,
in my experience. So
I agree completely, and I think that the reason that School Days works in light of the failure is that it's not a binary thing. It's not like if you're trying to punch someone and you fail, that you didn't punch them. It's that your punch didn't do anything, or that you can take it in another place. And honestly, the reason it works in School Days is not because of the system. The system is, I'll be honest, the Simple Six system is ridiculously light. It's almost not even a system.
Right.
It's there for when you don't know what to do when you're telling a story.
Right.
Because School Days works because we know the genre. It is a genre game. If you don't like the high school movie genre, you don't sort of get how those stories are supposed to go, it's not going to work for you. I don't make any apologies for that. It just is what it is. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we know when you're supposed to be embarrassed by the bully, and we know that when you're supposed to get your revenge on the bully, and we know how these things are supposed to go. So you can let failure happen because you can be like, "Oh man, I'm that hard luck kid that never has a break going for him, and won't it be fun to tell that story, you know?"
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, definitely. That's great.
Cool. Now I'm looking at something else called Terraform. I didn't get to see this at the last con I saw you at.
That is because I have only publicly playtested it twice, and the designs of it that I playtested are not the direction that I'm going to be going with it.
Nice.
Okay.
Terraform is an idea that it's actually it's the first idea that I had after school days.
Conceptually, it's wonderful.
Thank you. It's been baking now for a couple of years, and obviously, just looking from our production record, there have been other projects that have, through effort or opportunity, been it's been the right time to do them. And Terraform has needed to sit there for a little while. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think what's going to happen with Terraform, I don't have a when for it, but I do have a strong feeling that it's going to be based on Apocalypse World.
Nice.
Whereas previously I had talked about doing some stuff with Fate, and for a while I even tinkered with a mashup of Fate and Apocalypse World.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I really, and to give the listeners a quick elevator pitch for Terraform, and I'm just going to say it now, you're going to need to tag this podcast explicit.
Sorry.
Yeah, I know, he told me about the joke. The elevator pitch for Terraform is the Earth is fucked, mm-hmm. and the One World government has said, all right, it's our planet, we want to keep it, we're going to take everyone and put them on these lovely orbital stations that we've created, and we're going to put them in cryosleep, and we're going to terraform our own planet, we're going to fix it. And the problem is that not everyone makes it off planet. And so you play through the survivors who are just there, and it plays out in three phases. The first phase is departure. So you have to deal with all of the toxic, awful nastiness that, you know, that the Earth is in the middle of, which is why it needs to be fixed. You know, whatever that toxic nastiness is, and you have to figure out a way to craft a stable enough society to survive unto the next generation. Phase two is 2, 3, 4 generations later, and it is regenesis. That's when the terraforming is actually happening, and you have to survive that process, playing as, you know, the descendants of your previous characters, either direct descendants or, you know, you can just be from the same community, whatever. And, you know, there are giant machines and nanoswarms, and why did this goop turn my hand into a claw, and that sort of thing. And then the third phase is homecoming, where another 4 or 5 generations later, we are the people and this is our land, and, you know, you survived, and maybe you've kept the history of what happened. Maybe it's been shifted. Maybe it's your mythology now. Maybe it's your religion. Who knows? And everyone who is in cryosleep up above you is coming home to a planet that they think is clean and empty and theirs.
Is this the three phases? Are they all designed to be played in a single session?
Absolutely not.
Okay,
that would be nuts. No, the idea for the phases came about because I realized that I'm really bad at running long term campaigns, and I usually get about 5 or 6 sessions of a good solid arc before things drift to the point that I need to move on to something else. So each phase is going to be about 5 or 6 sessions long. It's a good enough time to see things develop. It's a good enough time to establish some nice solid characters and plot arcs, and then wrap everything up and proceed to the next phase. And the reason I want to do this with some variation on Apocalypse World is I'm thinking of a variety of playbooks, like the Enforcer, the Doctor, the Criminal, that sort of thing, right, for the first phase. But then in the second phase, think about how those roles change and mutate with society.
Right.
So the Doctor becomes the patcher or the field medic or something. And given the technology that you have available, how do your moves change? What's that progression like? And then in the third phase, the Doctor becomes the medicine man or the shaman. You know, and one nice little twist is, instead of, if you get like an advancement, instead of spending it on your character, you can spend it on the setting to retain,
nice.
to make sure something continues. So say the Doctor took a move that allows them to use, you know, nanotech to patch people up, right? And they spend an advance on making sure the nanotech survives. So no matter what happens, in the next phase, 4 or 5 generations later, they're going to have this nanotech around and be able to use it for whatever. And then four or five generations after that, the shaman has his mystical juju pouch, which is really nanotech, but they don't know that anymore.
Right.
You know, so,
the chance that he does and the motions that he does are actually the code necessary to make the nanotech activate and become healing. Yep. That's great.
And the one playbook that I think will be a lot of fun to design is the android, because it won't change. Right. It will just degrade.
Nice.
So in the second phase, it'll still be around, but maybe it doesn't work quite as well as it used to or whatever. And in the third phase, it's like the half-broken oracle that remembers, you know, corrupted bits of what the past was actually like. And like the Iron Man stuff, I want the players to have a lot of input on what the setting looks like. So there's going to be random setting generation and all that stuff. But when I actually will have, you know, the opportunity to really dive into that and make it what I want it to be, I don't have an answer to, unfortunately.
Fair enough. Well, I still await it with a bated breath, so.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, you should
that.
Brush your teeth. yeah, it sounds like you've got it well thought out for something that's really not, you know, slated for release anytime soon. Yeah.
It's kind of an artifact of doing all this stuff in public.
Because
a lot, like, I sort of try and model Daniel Salas, the card and board game designer. In this is that he's said before, and I've seen other people who work on this kind of stuff, that ideas are a dime a dozen, and they are. Everyone has them. It's the execution of them and the ability to do that that is what, you know, makes you a designer. So I see no harm in talking about ideas out in public. And if I come up with an idea and float it out there and it gets a lot of traction and people are really digging it, I feed off of that, and then I get more more inspired about whatever it is that I'm doing. And Terraform, especially being the second idea that I came up with, it's had a lot of time to marinate. I've been thinking about it off and on for 2 years now. And people see it, and just like the reaction that you had, you know, it's they're interested in it. They want to see where it's going to go and what it's going to do. And so that keeps it sort of on a low boil in the back of my mind. And at any point in time, if someone asks me about it, like you guys did, I can just sort of riff on it. But again, it's just kind of like having an extended idea. I haven't done what I want to say I want to do with it yet. So I guess the proof will be in the pudding.
You're here.
Well, there's a lot of detail up on your the Sand and Steam site.
Yeah, it was my project of choice for a while. And then either system considerations or, you know, real life concerns or, you know, my own limitations as a designer that I was maybe half consciously aware of. I ran into those things and just said, okay, this needs to be shelved for a little bit. You know, and I've got, I mean, if you look through the archives on the website, for stuff that's not in that top banner, I've got probably 8 other project ideas that I've talked about that, you know, again, they're all just sort of there in the back of my mind. And those are the ones I've decided to talk about. You should see my idea file.
I'm sure.
I'd like to.
I think we all would.
Maybe I'll post that up someday.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Okay.
That'd be cool.
All right. Well, I know we've mentioned every possible way to get a hold of you at some point during the podcast, but let's go ahead and recap them. Yes. How can somebody find you or get a hold of you?
The absolute best way, if you want to chat with and engage with me on a regular day-to-day basis, is Twitter. I love Twitter. Twitter is my friend. And I am at The Other Tracy, and that's T-R-A-C-Y. There is no E in there. So yes, no matter what your frame of reference is, I'm The Other Tracy.
Fair enough.
There's at least one, and depending on the spheres you walk in, 2 far better known Tracys in the game design industry. Tracy Hickman and Tracy Hurley. And they both spell their name the same way. So I'm The Other Tracy. You can find the website at sandandsteam.net.
All one word?
All one phrase, yep. You can email me, Tracy at sandandsteam.net. That's pretty simple. You can find me on Google Plus or Facebook if you so choose. If you want to have an extended conversation, Google Plus is probably the best place to do that.
There you go.
Facebook is Facebook. It's there mainly so my mom can keep up on what I'm doing. I do have a Sandinstein page, but I've never found a good way to leverage it.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to keep Google Plus and Twitter as my primary modes of communication.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, as for us, Tracy, if you're interested,
yes,
you can find us on Twitter at Rule Zero Podcast.
Yes. Just yes, I actually, I already follow the Rule Zero Podcast yes. on the Twitter.
Oh, fantastic. Because you can also get a hold of us at our website, the RuleZeroPodcast.com.
Well, there's no the.
I'm sorry, RuleZeroPodcast.com.
Very good. And I would also recommend, Tracy and our listeners, mm-hmm. you can like us on Facebook.
Yes, you can.
Excellent. That way your mom can know that you like the Rule Zero Podcast.
Exactly.
Excellent. And you can also email the show mm-hmm. by emailing RuleZeroPodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can email each one of us. You can reach me at Pete@RuleZeroPodcast.com.
Or me with Chris@RuleZeroPodcast.com.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think we covered it all.
Yeah, I think we have. Is there any, do we Semaphore? Morse code, do we...
smoke signals?
You can, if you want to get a hold of us, you can put a message in a cigar box and bury it in your backyard, and our underground agents will contact you.
Exactly.
Excellent. Yes, and I also accept messages attached to bottles of bourbon.
Oh, there you go. Here, here.
Excellent, yeah. And Pigeon as well. And you know what? We do have a Google Plus page.
Oh, we do?
So,
that's right.
Yeah, go ahead and find that. Yeah. And we have a Tumblr, too, but, you know, we have, like, one picture up.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
Yes, oh, Tumblr.
It's a crotch shot, too, which is...
oh, okay, yeah, okay, that's the second. We have two pictures of it. I made a mock-up of the Infinity Gauntlet
Thanos
comic book cover, mm-hmm. and I called it Thanos, the Hand of Fate.
Nice.
Oof.
Nice.
A terrible pun, but it amused me to write it.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
So it was great talking to you, Tracy. Thanks a lot for taking your time and coming and talking to us tonight.
Oh yeah, I was happy to have the opportunity. Thank you guys for having me on.
Of course.
Okay.
Maybe we'll have you back. I hope so.
Yeah, we'll definitely try to get something going after the Kickstarter gets going. Okay, maybe get some publicity up. Yeah,
sure, definitely. That'd be fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right, man.
Well, thanks a lot. That's it for me.
And that's it for me.
How about you, Tracy?
I'm out.
Okay.
Right. Game on.
Game on. Rule Zero Podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. You can use our podcast in your music video or send us to your friends and family, but be sure to mention our names on our website at www.rulezeropodcast.com. Segment and closing music is by Maggie Sansone, used by permission, and is available at maggiesmusic.com.